You can meet and hear 12-time All-American swimmer Riley Gaines, journalist Mark and Molly Hemingway, Aaron Wren of the American Conservative, Chris Roseborough of Fighting for the Faith, and Pastor Brian Wolfmiller of Has American Christianity Failed at the 2024 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, July 12th and Saturday, July 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org. It has been decades, probably the better part of 50 years, since voices in, usually out of evangelicalism, sometimes the political right, were warning about the secularization of U.S. society. Well, it's gone far beyond secularization. It's something else now. It's not just secular. It's positively pagan. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about the paganization of America, John Daniel Davidson. He's senior editor at The Federalist and author of the new book, Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity and the Dark Age to Come. John, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
How does the survival of our system of government, and more particularly our rights, depend on the continued influence of Christianity?
Yeah, one of the things that I argue at the beginning of the book is that America is and always was intended to be a Christian nation. I know we have gotten out of the habit of thinking of that way about our country over the past generation or two. But historically, especially in the founding era, it was understood that a republic of self-governing citizens was only going to be possible in a certain kind of society, a majority Christian society, not just in which Christianity sort of informed public life, but in which most of the people were actually practicing Christians. And if you read the founders and sort of the commentary that they had about what it was that they thought they were doing, this is pretty clear. You know, we tend to latch on to Thomas Jefferson as like representative of what the founders thought, but he was really an outlier. There was a diversity of views about theology and about religion, but most of the founders understood what they were doing was creating a system of government and a society that only worked with what they called true religion, by which they meant Christianity, and a civic square that was informed and shaped by the Christian religion.
What is paganism?
Paganism, we tend to think of as sort of, you know, the worship of Zeus and Apollo, or of nature religion, the worship of trees or the sun or the moon. But I think we have to understand that paganism is larger than that. It is those things, but it's more than that too, because paganism was also an entire social system and political system, an entire ethos about how society should be ordered, how the relationships between the powerful and the weak should be managed, and what really is truth. And I think when we understand paganism in its full context, we begin to be able to see how it's emerging in our time. One of the things that I note at the outset is that a good working definition of the pagan ethos comes from the Middle Eastern warlord in the 9th century, whose order gave us the word assassins, who famously said, "Nothing is true, everything is permitted." And that sums up, I think, the pagan ethos, that nothing is true, everything is permitted. The only thing that is true in the pagan world, and this holds true across time and geography when you look at pagan societies and empires of the past, is that what is true or right or just is determined on power. If you're powerful enough to impose your will, then that is what is true. And that is what we have seen in the past. And what I argue is that that is going to emerge again in our time, that ethos, as Christianity declines and fades from public life.
Talk about those past forms of paganism. How had they shaped both governments and societies?
Yeah, the most famous one, arguably the pinnacle of the pagan society, was the Roman Empire. And Again, I get into this in the book, talking just try to give practical examples of how this view of truth and reality and justice sort of worked itself out in Roman society. I think we tend to romanticize the pagan world. We romanticize the Roman Empire, especially, and this sort of started in the 19th century. It started with maybe even before that in the Romantic movement, romanticizing the pagan past rather than really having a clear-eyed view of how brutal and violent it was. In the pagan empire, if you were a Roman citizen, a male Roman citizen of rank and stature, you could do whatever you wanted to almost anyone, as long as they weren't your social equal. You could rape your slaves. You could kill them with impunity. If you were a child or a woman who was not in the ruling class, you were subject to all kinds of victimization. Sex slavery and the sex industry was huge in the Roman Empire. Men, women, and children. They didn't have any rights. They were viewed often as subhuman. So we need to be clear about what paganism was, right? And I target the Roman Empire here because it's easy enough to look at the Carthaginians, right, who sacrificed children, or the Aztecs, who engaged in wholesale industrial human sacrifice, as really, really horrible. But we tend to romanticize Rome. We need to be clear that even in a quote-unquote advanced pagan society, there's still this fundamental idea about power and society and justice prevailed to create a remarkably brutal society in which the powerful did what they wanted to the weak and the powerless, and that was considered just.
How was the idea of religion as a purely private matter, really in many ways, the beginning of the end for Christian influence in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, if we jump forward thousands of years, we get to the middle of the last century, and there was a profound shift in the years leading up to World War II. It was a shift that began long before then, but it came to a head in 1940 in a pair of Supreme Court cases. Not that the Supreme Court cases were sort of the sea change, but they were indicative of a sea change that was underway. And what these cases sort of decided was that, and it was a break, they decided this as a break from the past understanding that we had as a country and as a society about religion's influence on public life. And these cases essentially said the government cannot have anything to say about religion. And the one case in question was a case where Jehovah's Witnesses were fined by, I believe it was the state of Connecticut, for not obtaining a license. At the time, the state of Connecticut required you to have a license to go door to door soliciting charitable or religious donations. And the Jehovah's Witnesses did not do this. And so they got fined. They took their case to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled that states that require a regulation are also requiring a state official to determine what is a religious cause and what is not. And that, they said, was an unconstitutional establishment of religion. No Supreme Court, indeed no court in the United States ever, had considered such a thing to be an establishment of religion. It was a shift in the way we understand that phrase. Establishment of religion was taxing people to pay for a state church. But this represented, like I said, a sea change in how we understood the role of religion and what extent government could and could not encourage religious practice or religious values. And it reflected the shift, as you say, of a privatization of religion, that religion has to be cordoned off into only private spaces. It cannot be part of the public square. It cannot inform public policy. And indeed, the government, even at the state level, cannot have anything to say about what even is or is not a religion. And that was a big change.
With the exception of atheistic communism, had that ever been in the Western world considered, that religion is a purely private affair?
No. I mean, even when you look at the revolution that ran parallel to ours, the French Revolution, they attacked the church, the Catholic Church especially, quite openly in horrible ways. but they instituted their own sort of civic religion and were really clear about what they were doing. In other words, even the French revolutionaries understood that there was a place for religion in public life. In their case, they just wanted it to be the quote-unquote religion of reason, which I discuss in the book as sort of a, was itself a sort of neo-pagan idea. But the idea that religion itself had to be private and could not have any bearing on public policy or public life, that was a new thing. And it was part of a radical secularization of American life that, as I said, had been going on for some time, but really picked up steam and took on new and aggressive forms in the middle of the 20th century.
Historically, how did Christianity bring about, in many places, the death of old paganism?
That's a pretty broad question, but for our purposes, we can look at Europe, post-Roman Empire Europe, where Christianity slowly, over the course of centuries, defeated and absorbed the paganism of the various European peoples and people in the former Roman Empire. One of the ways it did that was by going after paganism, not just on a religious level, but attacking paganism at the level of society, right? Because paganism wasn't just a set of beliefs about what gods were and what man was, but it was also a societal system. It was a political system and a system of control. And so even initially in the Roman Empire, you know, the attraction of Christianity to those classes of people that had no power in the Roman Empire was immediate. Converts among women and among urban dwelling Roman residents and Roman citizens of the empire transformed over time as Christianity matured and grew and spread out into the rustic areas, the rustici, right? That's what pagans were. They were people who lived outside the cities. Christianity went out from there and became established in the countryside. And it proposed a radical new way of organizing society simply based on the Christian doctrine of Imago Dei, that every man, woman, and child is created in the image and likeness of God. It has inherent dignity and has inherent worth. The idea of human rights is not a secular idea. It's a very old idea that emerged in Christian medieval Europe and was articulated more than 1,000 years ago and defended over and against the pagan ideal, which did not see human beings as created in the image and likeness of God, did not see them as with any inherent dignity. And this was, you know, I think it's hard to overstate how transformative and revolutionary that was as an idea that drew people into Christianity, but also as an idea that changed how society was organized. And there's many historical examples of that going back, as I said, more than 1,000 years.
It is under the influence of Christianity, some direct, some indirect, that the American founders began the American experiment. Did they envision a strict separation of church and state?
No, they didn't. And this is a huge thing that we misunderstand and have misinterpreted today. I would argue some people have misinterpreted it intentionally. None of the founders would understand separation of church and state the way we use that phrase today, like what we mean by that. When you look back at the founding era, at the time that the First Amendment was ratified, at the time that the Constitution was adopted, a number of states already had established churches. In other words, they had publicly supported religious establishments at the state level. Many others would adopt these kinds of establishments or retain them for well into the 19th century, not just established churches, but also other laws about who could run for office. I think famously it was in New Jersey up all the way up until 1877. You couldn't stand for election for the state assembly if you were a Roman Catholic because over fears of divided loyalties. But these laws were on the books and stayed on the books after the ratification of the First Amendment and the adoption of the Constitution. And it wasn't seen as a conflict. Now, eventually these states would all get rid of their establishments, but it wasn't understood at the time to be a conflict between religious liberty and having an establishment at the state level. What the founders were interested in was not having an establishment at the federal level. They didn't think it was within the power of the federal government to impose an establishment on the states or on American citizens. And that's what they were after. They didn't want a society in which church or religious life was separated from public life. They wanted a non-sectarian nation. But in all of their pronouncements, even from George Washington right off the bat, their public pronouncements, their invocations, the laws that the early Congress passed, there's no indication that they saw this. In fact, one of the first things that the first Congress did was appropriate money for a congressional chaplain. They did this before they ratified the First Amendment. Now, how could a group of people who think there should be a separation between church and state also think that it's appropriate to use taxpayer dollars to pay for a chaplain for Congress, right? So I think we've lost the plot on this whole separation of church and state idea, which I think was much more something that Thomas Jefferson believed and pushed for, but was not a widely held view among the founding generation.
John Daniel Davidson is our guest. We're talking about the paganization of America. When we come back, many of those founders were not creedal Christians. Some of them were, but many of them were closer to deists. We'll see what he thinks about that.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Hope for Healing, April 19th and 20th in Irvine, California, is a conference designed to address the issue of gender brokenness and more. Hope for Healing is for high school and college youth, as well as adults. Join Y for Life and Lutherans for Life to find out what makes your body a good gift and what happens when gender is disordered. Learn more and register at yforlife.org. Hope for Healing, April 19th and 20th in Irvine, California. Y4life.org.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free.
Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University, Chicago.
Indeed, the quest for truth is at the core of a university's purpose. The liberal arts, illuminated by the revealed truths of Scripture, are powerful for equipping students for a life of self-governance. A disciple is one who follows the Master. So what does it mean to follow Jesus? He said that it means to take up one's cross. The cross is thus the symbol of dying for others, of dying to self for the sake of serving others. And a life of service is a life well lived.
Truth, Freedom, Vocation. Concordia University, Chicago. CUChicago.edu.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the paganization of America with John Daniel Davidson, author of the new book, Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity and the Dark Age to Come. Before the break, you were talking about the founders and their kind of lack of views on the separation of church and state. How do you respond to someone who says that many of those founders weren't creedal Christians? Some of them were, but many of them were closer to deists.
I think that despite their deism or how closely held their religious beliefs may or may not have been, with some of them, it's hard to tell. George Washington, I'm thinking of especially, clearly had some sort of a religious faith, but he was very careful in his public pronouncements and even in his letters to avoid any hint of sectarianism. And I think it's because he understood, all these guys understood the potential danger of sectarianism in politics and in public life. All they had to do was look at Europe, where they'd had a century of religious warfare. They were trying to find a way out of that. But the deists, I think, understood that you still could not have the kind of society that they were proposing to organize, the kind of government that they were proposing, without a religious and moral people. And I think they all understood that religious and moral peoples were shaped by the Christian faith. They were not talking about Islam. They were not talking about Buddhism when they talked about capital T true religion. They were talking about Christianity. And I think even those who were deists who may not have been creedal Christians, as you say, would understand the need for a robust creedal Christianity in order to sustain the new republic.
How did the Industrial Revolution eventually bring about a shift in the place of Christianity in American life?
Well, the Industrial Revolution brought about a transformation, not just in the religious life, but in almost every area of life imaginable. One of the ways that it did this was by breaking up communities that had been sources of religious solidarity, had been sources of physical sustenance, and drove people to cities to work in factories. And this transformed the United States. Indeed, it transformed much of the world. But it began a process of rupture that would continue with a series of events, some of them massive wars. Even the Civil War took place right on the cusp of the sort of the first Industrial Revolution in the United States. World War I coincided with a time of great industrial upheaval, with the concentration of agricultural operations and, again, the movement of people into cities, and again in World War II. So these things did transform American life. It uprooted people from their traditional communities and put them into new contexts. It also brought massive new numbers of immigrants with different religious traditions into the United States. And it began kind of a process of secularization, as we mentioned earlier, that would manifest itself around the middle of the 20th century in these new ideas about what the role of religion really was. And I think that you can't separate these ideas about what the role of religion is and should be in public life from the way of life of a people. And by that, I mean a primarily, prior to the Industrial Revolution, an agrarian way of life. Most Americans lived in rural areas on farms, and that was how they sustained themselves. And when you rip all that out and you usher in a radically new way of living for a people, it's going to change how they understand really basic things about society, how it should be organized, about the relationship between the citizen and the government, and the role of religion in the life of the nation. And that's what we saw during this really tumultuous time in our history.
You described some of it earlier, but legally, how did governmental neutrality on religion ensconce itself?
This was part of what I was referring to in these Supreme Court cases that began cropping up in the 1940s, and they would continue with some intensity in the 1960s and 70s, famously, you know, ruling that prayer would not be allowed in public schools and Bible reading would not be allowed in public schools. The idea that the government had to treat all religions as the same, by which they meant it had to be neutral on the question of religion. It could not sort of seem to endorse one religion over another, but it stemmed from this idea that the government has no interest in religion and that public life needs to be quarantined from the religious life of the people. And that was an idea that took its earliest forms, as we said earlier, in saying, well, the state welfare office isn't competent to even say what is a religion and what isn't, what is a religious cause and what isn't a religious cause, because the government has to be completely neutral, has to be completely agnostic about religious matters. This was where we first started seeing that phrase from Thomas Jefferson, the separation, a wall of separation between church and state, started seeing that phrase in Supreme Court opinions. this was not how those questions had been adjudicated up to this point in our history. There had been a number of religious liberty cases where the question about the government, whether federal or state's role in religion, was at issue. And those questions, up until the 1940s, were decided on a kind of case-by-case basis, where the interests of the government and the interests of the citizens who were seeking redress from whatever government regulation was in question, those interests were weighed and balanced and adjudicated. But never before did the justices come out and make a sweeping proclamation that the government has no interest in the question of religion and no competency to promote religion in public life at all. This was totally alien. This would have been totally alien to the founding fathers and the generations of Americans that came after them. They all understood and would have agreed that, of course, the government, not just the government at the federal level, but also the state and local governments, have an interest in promoting religious piety among the citizens. And there's reams of evidence for it throughout our history. And we need to understand, I think, that the middle of the 20th century brought a break with that tradition and a whole new way of understanding the relationship between religion and the government.
You say that not only the quantity, but also the quality of religious devotion is on the decline. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's no secret that the quantity of Christian practice and the number of Christians is on the decline. It's easily measurable, has been easily measurable for some time. But when I say the quality is also on the decline, I'm talking about the theological corruption of the Christian faith by secularism and really by paganism. That is to say, the disfigurement of reason on the questions of religion and the corruption of Christian doctrine. And you can see this, you know, a lot of the surveys that track religious attendance, membership in churches, the likelihood of children to adopt the faith traditions of their parents. A lot of these surveys also delve into the substance of belief of self-identifying Christians. And what you see over time, and especially in recent years, is a departure from traditional Christian orthodoxy, small o orthodoxy, on a whole host of questions. You see this among Protestants. You see it among Catholics. You especially see it among evangelicals. When surveyed, will give remarkably surprising answers about what they say the substance of their belief is. And so, for example, you have shockingly high numbers of evangelicals in recent surveys say that they believe that Christianity teaches that everyone is basically a good person, that hell doesn't exist, that there are no definitive teachings in Christianity about marriage, right? About men and women in marriage, or about human sexuality. In the Catholic Church, you see shocking departures from what has always been bedrock Catholic teaching and dogma, such as belief in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, right? The teaching of the doctrine of transubstantiation. Shockingly high numbers of Catholics don't believe that. And so what I argue in going through all these surveys in the book is that the decline of Christianity in sheer numbers is being accompanied with a decline of Christianity in terms of the small orthodoxy of Christian faith. And the faith itself is becoming corrupted in a society that is becoming increasingly secular and indeed pagan.
So I guess that kind of answers the question. The secularization of America does not mean that Americans are becoming irreligious, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I say this at the outset of the book. Secularism is like a bridge, right? It's not the final destination. It's a mistake for us to think that as Christianity declines in America and we enter this post-Christian era, that the post-Christian era in the West is going to be this kind of secular, neoliberal, libertarian, live and let live kind of utopia. That is not what's happening. That's not what's going to happen. The future of America is not secularism. That's part of the argument behind the title of the book. The future of America is pagan. Secularism is this brief moment where liberalism shakes off its association with Christianity, from which it came and on which it relies, and pretends for a generation or two that it is possible to just be liberal and retain all of the values and principles and benefits of Christendom without the religion of Christianity. It is not possible. We are witnessing in real time right now secular liberalism decay and devolve into a new form of paganism, a post-Christian, post-liberal form of paganism. That's what the future holds. It's not going to be a secular society. And that's why I say too in the book that the pagan America that's coming into being isn't going to be the kind of place that even a secular liberal is going to want to live, because it's not going to be a place that enjoys sort of the inheritance of Christianity without replenishing it. It's going to completely reject that inheritance.
Will it still claim to be secular and neutral while being pagan?
The vestiges and the language will persist for a time. We even see right now, you know, in some of the big cultural fights that are underway right now, that the language that secular liberalism inherited from Christianity, language about rights, right? Inclusivity, dignity, that language is still employed in something like the transgender debate or in the abortion debate. Even when the substance of that, the pro-trans position or the pro-abortion position, has nothing to do with dignity or rights or inclusivity and has everything to do with power, we're going to see, I think rather quickly, those terms and that sort of linguistic framing, the nods to our Christian inheritance of the past, we're going to see those things dropped. And there's not even going to be a pretense anymore that this is about rights or about dignity or about equality. And we're already seeing that play out. You notice the shift in recent years away from talking about equality and talking about equity now. That's, I know the words sound similar, but they're profoundly different. And the latter, equity, implies the exercise of state power over and against institutions and individuals to achieve certain outcomes that the state desires. It has nothing to do with equality, and it has everything to do with power. And so I think we're going to start seeing, and increasingly are seeing, this shift away from the language of Christianity that liberalism inherited toward the language of power, which is a hallmark of the pagan world.
John Daniel Davidson is our guest, author of the new book, Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity in the Dark Age to Come. We will get a brief definition of modern paganism as it stands next. You can meet and hear 12-time All-American swimmer Riley Gaines, journalists Mark and Molly Hemingway, Aaron Wren of the American Conservative, Chris Roseborough of Fighting for the Faith, and Pastor Brian Wolfmiller of Has American Christianity Failed at the 2024 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, July 12th and Saturday, July 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start. The foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Life Ministry cares for pregnant women sharing the love of Christ. Listen to Pastor Ed DeWitt with Redeeming Life Outreach Ministries.
One of the first residents we had said to me, "Pastor, why do you do this?" And I said, "Just stick with me through this class, and when we're done, you'll understand completely." Many of the women, as they go through the instruction, when we get to that part about baptism, they're like, "Pastor, I want that for my baby. I want my baby to be adopted into God's family."
God's mission here, lcms.org/national mission.
Hey, young adults, are you finding it harder and harder to meet and connect with other Lutheran men and women? Join us at University Lutheran Church in Champaign, Illinois on Saturday, April 6th for the Martin plus Katie Conference. We'll talk about being men and women in Christ, meet new friends, get to know each other, and have fun. Register at martinpluskatie.org. That's MartinPluskatie.org. Registration closes on Palm Sunday.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the paganization of America. John Daniel Davidson is our guest, senior editor at The Federalist and author of the new book, Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity and the Dark Age to Come. Christianity in a Negative World with Aaron Wren of the American Conservative. Men competing in women's sports with 12-time All-American swimmer Riley Gaines. The 2024 elections with journalists Mark and Molly Hemingway. These are some of the topics and speakers at the 2024 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. This year's conference is Friday, July 12th and Saturday, July 13th at Concordia University of Chicago. Attendance is limited. Affordable online dorm options are available. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or just give us a call, 618-223-8385. Making the Case, July 12th and 13th in River Forest, Illinois. John, describe modern paganism. How would you put it on the back of a napkin?
Modern paganism is, I think, one of its main characteristics is the disfigurement of reason and the embrace of radical moral relativity. And it's also bound up with the idea that of sort of therapeutic self-realization and therapeutic kind of deism. And by that, I mean, when you look at something like the rising popularity of witchcraft, especially among young women. And there's a chapter where I talk about this on social media, especially you have like witchcraft influencers and a big community on TikTok, you know, hashtag witch talk. But the witchcraft that is popular among this group is very much a sort of therapeutic feminist witchcraft that talks a lot about empowerment and breaking the patriarchy, things like that. So they talk about these things almost as secularists. And the new form of paganism is, for right now, an amalgam of a secular mindset, a secular liberal mindset, and a pagan mindset that sees forces, spiritual forces, and realities that are available to you to reach out and get in touch with to aid you in your empowerment and in throwing off the shackles of the patriarchy. When you listen to what a lot of these people say, they are very careful to make clear that they're not worshiping these gods. They're consulting with them. They are seeking advice and help from these deities, these spiritual beings, right? But they don't see themselves worshiping them. And I argue that what this is an example of what C.S. Lewis called the materialist magician in the Screwtape Letters, which is a person who does not recognize the reality of spiritual beings that it may in fact be enthralled to, but does recognize the validity of spiritual forces. And in this way, they're able to retain their fundamental materialist outlook on the world and retain some sort of vestige of being a sort of a secular materialist, while also engaging in pagan practices and beliefs that have nothing to do with secular materialism or scientific materialism, that are totally faith-based, that accept the idea of an enchanted world. And that's the kind of paganism that we're seeing emerge in our time. It's a synthesis of scientific materialism with pagan spiritualism. And it's working itself out and it's coming into being right now. And it's something that Lewis and others saw was coming in the last century.
You say that the mental health crisis among youth is really a civilization crisis. What do you mean by that?
The mental health crisis among the youth is a civilizational crisis in the sense that it is a religious crisis. We are not giving our young people a world or a way to make sense of the world that is satisfying, that makes sense. In other words, the secular sort of liberal materialist utopia that we thought we were bequeathing to our children doesn't exist. And doesn't create for happy communities and doesn't create for thriving young people or families, because it relies on an inheritance that it cannot itself generate. It relies on a vitality and a view of the world and of human relationships that itself undermines. And that, of course, is religious community, Christian community, and Christian idea of family and community. It's very clear that the mental health crisis that we see playing out among our youth right now is a spiritual crisis. It's a crisis of meaning about what is man, what is God, what is life for, what are families for, what are communities for, what is the good, what is true, what is beautiful, right? That is not a mental health crisis in the way that the old secular liberal materialists think of it, you know, something to be treated, something that could be medicated. It is a spiritual crisis, and it's a crisis that has everything to do with the decline of Christianity in the West.
How is the traditional view of natural marriage a product of Christianity?
The traditional view of natural marriage, that is between one man and one woman, was something that was instituted by Christ. It's very clear in the scriptures. It was clear from the very beginning of the Christian church that marriage was between one man and one woman, and that this marriage, this union of man and woman, in some ways was an incarnational symbol or representation of a theological reality about God. Jesus himself was very clear about this. The whole scripture is shot through with this idea of what man and woman are in relation to one another and what they are in relation to God. And this was carried forward as the Roman Empire collapsed and as Christianity spread, not just that marriage was between one man and one woman, but one of the big epochal things that the Catholic Church did in early medieval Europe was to restrict cousin marriages and say that the pagan peoples that were coming into the church, that were converting to Christianity, would not be allowed to be polygamous, and they would not be allowed to continue cousin marriage. And this reshaped Europe. It broke up these insular groups of pagan, clan-based pagan family tribes, created much broader networks of trust and new forms of social organization that were based on marriage, that were based on alliances through marriage between one man and one woman that bound families together that wouldn't have been bound together previously. But that's just one of the ways, right? I think that we can track the decline of marriage and really the destruction of marriage in the West with the emergence of all sorts of social ills that are becoming more and more obvious every day.
You had mentioned C.S. Lewis. He wrote about something he called the materialistic magician. What was he talking about?
Yeah, we mentioned this earlier. This was a phrase that came from the Screwtape Letters. The character Screwtape is writing to his nephew Wormwood, who is his understudy. These are demons writing. Screwtape is writing to his demon nephew about the patient, which is the person that Wormwood is assigned to corrupt and drag to hell. And Screwtape is answering a question from Wormwood about whether or not they should keep themselves concealed, whether the demons should keep their presence concealed from human beings. And Screwtape answers that for now, they do want to keep themselves concealed, because if they revealed themselves, it would undermine the scientific materialist worldview of modern man, which is very advantageous to the demons. They want to keep man believing that there is no such thing as demons and angels. There's no such thing as God, that the world is just a cold materialist place, and scientific realism is the only way to understand anything that's true about the world. Screwtape said that's a great victory that we have in convincing people that is true, and we don't want to undermine that by revealing ourselves. But he said, we look forward to a day when we can make ourselves known in a limited way so that the materialist man begins to believe in spiritual or non-material forces and begins to order his life and order society around the influence of these forces and seek them out for power and advantage while denying the existence of spirits. And he said, we will have achieved the perfect subject, which is the materialist magician. And he said, at that point, the end of the war will be in sight.
John Daniel Davidson is senior editor at The Federalist. He's author of the new book, Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity in the Dark Age to Come. You'll find a link to this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. John, thank you.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Next week on Issues Etc., we'll continue our interview with John Daniel Davidson on the paganization of America. We'll discuss Handel's Messiah on the Passion of Christ with Dr. Joseph Hurl, and we'll study the hymn A Lamb Goes Uncomplaining Forth with Dr. Arthur Just. Issues Etc. has been brought to you in part this week by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Life Ministry. LCMS Life Ministry speaks up for life, cares for people in body and soul, and teaches about the sanctity of human life. You'll find their pro-life resources at lcms.org/life. Advocating, educating, and caring for all human life, LCMS Life Ministry, lcms.org/life. I'm Todd Wilkin. Go to church on Sunday. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
This is Molly Hemingway, encouraging you to listen to my favorite podcast, Issues Etc. Every day you get in-depth interviews with host Todd Wilkin asking expert guests substantive, thought-provoking questions on all of the important news and issues of our day. The expert guests are in culture, law, ethics, philosophy, theology, and apologetics. Expert guests, expansive topics, always extolling Christ, Issues, etc.
This is Jeff Schwarz, General Manager of Lutheran Public Radio, with a message for listeners in the Mountain and Pacific time zones. We pledge to have Issues, etc. podcasts posted daily, no later than 5 p.m. Mountain, 4 p.m. Pacific. This will allow you to download and listen to the latest Issues Etc. podcast weekdays during your evening commute. Again, if you live in the Mountain or Pacific time zone, download Issues Etc. before you leave work and listen during your drive home.